Thank you, Ian Ozan. 908, somebody texted in. We're talking about John Kennedy doing better than as serious as four strokes and a heart attack. Somebody texted in and said, as serious as anybody trying to get between me and the first bite of a Parkway Bakery shrimp po' boy. That's serious stuff right there. You don't want to get between me and that either, as long as you dress it with butter and ketchup. That's the way I am. And a little bit of hot sauce.
Oh, no. Lettuce, tomato, and extra pickles.
Heathen,
with mayonnaise.
Out with you. Get out.
That's what fully dressed is. Lettuce, tomato, pickles, and mayonnaise.
Every time I went to Las Vegas and ordered a sandwich dressed, and they looked at me like,
versus what?
It's at Arby's of all places. What in the hell is wrong with you? Dressed. Dave Cohen, in case you don't know.
You want to add clothes on it?
Our news director, host of the highly rated and critically acclaimed early edition of WWL First News, joins us now to talk about yesterday and the inauguration that went on. It's certainly a historic day in the history of the city of New Orleans. One thing I'll say about Helena Moreno, and I'm just a dumb guy from the West Bank. I'm no Clancy Dubose, okay? But I think...
retired now.
Right. Whatever it is, she has it. Even with dealing with, and they had some technical snafus during the presentation. I'm not calling anybody out for that because there were some limitations as to who could get in the facility, when to rehearse what. It didn't go as smoothly as it perhaps could have, but even the fact that they were setting up the podium while she was speaking and she had the poise to point to her name on the podium as Helena Moreno mayor, I don't know what it is, but, and you can, this is not a news part, this is just an opinion part here, Dave, you can tell me what you think. I think her political future is very bright. I think she's got it all. She's got the poise of being a TV journalist, so she knows how to work the camera. I'm not saying this cynically. I'm just saying this observationally. She's an attractive woman. She's a very intelligent woman. She's personable. She's quick-witted. There's policy behind it. I think her future is pretty bright. Your thoughts on that?
Clearly, her background in television and public speaking has aided her greatly in her ability to be successful in politics.
Extremely comfortable.
And I think the failed congressional run was very important to her evolution in politics when she tried to make a huge leap in a short time and fell back and then decided she would step one rung at a time up the ladder. I think that was a learning experience for her, and I think that helped build that character that you're referencing, that it that you see. She's very comfortable in front of a crowd, very comfortable as part of a broadcast, and really has developed into someone who most people, when they hear her speak, can relate to her. Mm-hmm. She speaks to you.
That's a great point. That's
how you
exactly
want to be
right.
spoken to, rather than as a politician handing down decrees. She is more conversational and really seems to speak on a level that most people prefer to be addressed.
Not to look back, let's look forward, but you would never imagine Helena Moreno using a phrase like the city of New Orleans while you're addressing the city of New Orleans, because everybody knows that this is the city of New Orleans, right? So that I understand that fully. The other thing I noticed is that even the personal touches, like J.P. Morrell in his tennis shoes and those kind of things, it's done with a
the
smirk.
Joke she cracked.
Yeah. Right. And it's all innocent. And it's just, and J.P. Morrell laughed at it. And it just, all in all, give me your thoughts about the inauguration. You were there.
Yeah. And it was unlike any inauguration I've ever been a part of. And I've been to many mayoral, many gubernatorial, and other inaugural events, covered presidential inaugurations, never been at one, but been the voice of them here on WWL. And this was, and I said on the air yesterday with Newell, we went from an inaugural ceremony to an inaugural concert. Mm-hmm. And everyone embraced it. You know, I have never heard of a politician commissioning a song for their inauguration before. And it worked. And it was that the crowd was immediately immersed into it and bought into it and was a part of it. And it was kind of funny, and we didn't really get into this during the broadcast, but right after she finished her inaugural address, a lot of people who thought they would beat the crowd got up and left.
Oh, they missed half the show.
They came back.
Did they?
Okay. Yeah, because they realized as they were leaving and walking through the lobby area that something very big was going on because the rest of the people weren't following them out. So many of them turned around and came back. Some of them did miss it because they, at a normal inauguration, the crescendo is the inaugural address. The incoming individual gives their address, there's raucous applause, and everybody leaves. Not yesterday. There was an entire concert, and Helena Moreno up on stage dancing and smiling and embracing and then inviting the city council to come and dance on stage with her. This was a different kind of an event, which seemed appropriate for the different kind of mayor she intends to be and the different kind of city she wants New Orleans to now become.
We have an open invitation for her to come in where I can go up close and personal with her. I could spend 2 hours talking to her, just hearing her story. We got to see her parents yesterday. We'd not seen her parents before. Her husband, we've not known a lot about her husband before. And that's not that, you know, that's not a negative thing at all. It's just the way they've chosen to live their lives, and that's fine.
Yeah, he chooses to live his life out of the spotlight while she lives it fully embraced in the spotlight. And that works for them.
And that's, Lord knows, God bless him. That's fine. Tell me about the speech itself, the inaugural message itself, compared to other inaugural messages that you've heard.
It was brief in comparison, and it was less about specific initiatives and goals. Most politicians, and specifically mayors in New Orleans during their inaugural address, lay out very specific goals and plans that they have of things that they're going to immediately want to accomplish. Helena Moreno chose to make it more about the overarching theme of the next 4 years, to make it more about the faith, hope, and love, to make it more emotional and ethereal and not specifically saying, I'm going to do X, Y, and Z, but I'm going to bring new, different, and better. And that was the message that resonated, and I think it worked pretty well. She even had a little call and response with the audience mm-hmm. where she wanted them to be all in for New Orleans and wanted them to affirm, because all of the movers and shakers, all of the officials, everybody who on the upper levels will be a part of creating the change and the new city that she wants was sitting in those seats. Those 3,200 or so people are going to be crucial if she's going to be successful in doing what she wants. And she had the wherewithal to call upon them right there and then to commit to being a part of what she's trying to do.
Go on a record, so to speak. I was busy. The grand dogs are in town, so I was busy with these idiots yesterday. I didn't get a chance to see the grand dogs.
I heard you.
Okay, dogs, just to be clear. With these idiots pulling a rope, whatever they were doing, and trying to separate them. So I didn't see the national news. Did it receive much national play or not?
It did. The national message was a little different than the local message. Instead of being focused on the hope and change, it was more on the newness and the specific fact that the city has its first Hispanic mayor ever. But I didn't see a lot, and I didn't consume a lot of the national media yesterday because we were so immersed in it locally. So I don't know that I can really answer your question fully, but what I did see and hear was good coverage. It was all positive. It was in a positive light, but it was different than what the message was locally.
And the big story in the room, and I can't ignore it, Kamala Harris appearing on stage and speaking. How was that received in the room as far as you could tell? Was anybody surprised by this? Did the feeling, the atmosphere change, et cetera?
It did a little. There was mixed reaction. You could tell some people were unhappily surprised. Mm-hmm. Because there had been a theme throughout of inclusiveness, togetherness, unity, and any way you slice it, Kamala Harris is a polarizing, divisive figure.
She's a line in the sand, whether you like it or you don't. She is a line in the sand. Would you not agree?
Well, and she had to be. She was running against Donald Trump for president of the United States, and it became a very divisive, polarizing race. So she was the antithesis of Donald Trump during the campaign, and she was the far left to his far right. And so I think, and I've talked to a few analysts who believe that that was the only thing that happened during the inaugural celebration that did not bring people together. The music brought everyone together. The bipartisan presentations on stage brought everyone together. The multi-faith blessings brought everyone together. There was this coming together and sense of unity in a shared goal for the city of New Orleans. And that message was, to your earlier point, not only for the city and not only for the region and the state, but that was intended to be national and international. Mm-hmm. It was intended to send a message around the world and across the country that New Orleans is welcoming, open for business, wants expatriates to return. And in fact, Mayor Moreno even specifically called on people who have moved away or relocated their businesses to come back now because of these changes. But I think that the choice of Kamala Harris, and we could feel it in the room, and we've seen it on social media, on comments, on text streams, everywhere you look, there are folks who were disappointed, upset, angered by that decision, but there's others who loved it. The far left in the audience thought it was great. You know, here you have the only kind of visible head of the Democratic Party as it exists right now. We don't know what her future holds for Harris, if she's going to be in that number again or not. But that was the only thing of the entire event that was not about coming together. It was polarizing.
The only thing I thought is, from a political standpoint, you got to be careful what political corner you paint yourself into. Because you could either feel betrayed or you could feel, okay, she is a Democrat and she is what she is, what she proposes to be, and never proclaimed to be anything different. So you got to be careful before you rail about this and then support this. And then all of a sudden it's like, well, wait a minute, that doesn't fit into my Venn diagram here, right?
And clearly there was a conversation between Moreno and Harris about what would be said, because Harris did not say anything terribly divisive. Mm-hmm. She praised Moreno not for her politics, but for her hard work. She praised Moreno not for being a Democrat, but for being a person of the people. She praised her as an individual, not as a political figure. And I think that was something that Moreno's campaign, her transition team, had to have clearly talked about with Harris's folks who were helping prepare her comments, that we don't want this to become a far left commentary. We just want you to be there as a national figure, as a friend of Moreno's, there to praise her and support her.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but the other thing that stuck out to me was that that was the only moment that wasn't purple, gold, and green.
I think you're right.
Because everything else was local, local, New Orleans, New Orleans, New Orleans. And then all of a sudden, this Kamala Harris came in. It's like, well, wait, this is not
New Orleans. Are we red and blue now? Or
exactly. That's exactly right. Yeah. All right, let me take a break. We'll talk about the executive orders that Mayor Moreno signed yesterday. Dave Cohen's our guest, our news director. Got any questions or comments, text them in to 504-260-1870. They're pouring in, and we'll read some of them if we have a chance when we return on WWL. All right, 9:28, busy hour. We're going to talk to Simone Malaz in a minute, campaign director for Restore the Mississippi River Delta, about some public meetings on the Coastal Protection Restoration Authority's annual plan going on this week. Then we'll talk to Dane Cialino about the Supreme Court hearing arguments in that huge case about coastal damages in Louisiana. A couple of minutes left with Dave Cohen, our news director, as we recap the inauguration yesterday. Some executive orders that were signed by Mayor Moreno, and a big press conference today, I think.
Yes. Building on the amazing optimism that really the vast majority of people left the Sanger with yesterday, she is jumping right into action. Everything we just talked about that happened at the inauguration, I'm telling you, people were hugging, kissing, high-fiving, and really, really feeling good as they left there. Folks from both sides of the aisle about the future of New Orleans. Today, she's taking action on one of the executive orders she signed yesterday for the Lights on Street Stabilization Initiative. What this is she and the district attorney, the police chief, and others will get together, and they are going to vow to commit to this new plan to get all street lights on and darken the corners and the streets that have been left without lights for years and years, some since Hurricane Katrina, and get all of the traffic signals working, with the message that this will improve public safety by making the city brighter and sending a message, and it'll improve overall quality of life.
Thank you, Dave Cohen. Appreciate it, as always. Something else to look at, maybe street signs, because we're still missing street signs from Katrina, which is hard to believe, but we are. Thank you. Simone Malaz joins us now, campaign director for Restore the Mississippi River Delta. Good morning, Simone. How are you?
Good morning, Tommy. How are you?
I'm okay. Tell me what's going on with some meetings that are taking place.
Yeah, it's that time of year. We annually talk about a coastal plan, right? So they have this big master plan that is a bigger vision that takes us 50 years into the future, but they break that down into an annual plan. And really, it's really simple. This is what their coastal priorities will be for this next year and for the couple years after that. And so we saw a lot of changes in the coastal program over the past couple of years, and so we want to let folks know when these meetings are, what kind of projects they're talking about, and we want them to ask questions about timeline and cost and ways that they plan to protect our coastal communities.
So the first one's already happened yesterday at 5:30. Any takeaways from that, Simone?
Yeah, so they've actually done a couple in each region. Last week, they were here in Jefferson, and they focused on some of the priorities here in Southwest Southeast Louisiana. The good news is that there's a virtual meeting still remaining. That meeting will be Thursday, and they will go through the entire coast. They'll highlight projects from each region. And so you want to know what's happening in Southwest Louisiana, South Central Louisiana, Southeast Louisiana. That's a good meeting to tune into. But Tommy, you can go to the meeting is one thing, but what we really want is to encourage people to comment. There are so few opportunities sometimes to weigh in on what our future coast looks like, and this is a good chance to do it. There's an open comment period. Comments close on Mardi Gras.
How binding is any of this?
That's a very good question. So this was part of the major changes that were made after Hurricanes Katrina and Rita, when we said, listen, we have to prioritize our coast and our coastal programs. So there are state statutes and laws that outline this process, and because it has to go to the Louisiana legislature for a vote. So the legislators that represent you in Baton Rouge, they have a say on what this plan says. But really, Tommy, this is they're asking to spend this money. They're saying, hey, we need the authority. We want to spend money on these projects for our coast. And so really, it's that authority that they're asking for that they have to go to Baton Rouge and get the approval of the legislators on.
So let me go back to Mid-Barataria sediment diversion. The money was approved, but then the governor pulled a plug on it, right? So that's why I asked about how binding is it.
Yeah, very good question. So, and you know, you've been following this topic for a very long time. Last year's annual plan had money included for those major sediment diversions. Tommy, you know this, that was hundreds of millions that would ultimately lead to billions of dollars being invested. And now that's no longer. Mm-hmm. So how are we spending that money? What is the state's priorities? And really, what's the timeline for implementing the projects in the next couple of years? Those are good questions to ask because of that major change that happened from last year to this year.
So again, I'm not trying to poo-poo anything, but if you get involved in these meetings, if the legislature meets and appropriates this money and approves it and they vote for it, but then the whole thing can be short-circuited at the end, is that right or not?
Well, I think there's always a healthy discussion when it comes to accountability and who's in charge of making these decisions. I will say it helps me to sleep better at night knowing that I used my voice to say what was important to me, and I want to make sure that our coastal communities are using that same opportunity. I think from there, Tommy, it is a little bit about process, but the fact that they go to Baton Rouge and they ask the legislators for this approval, and then, you know, there's all kind of things that happen after that, including asking for permits. You have to go to the Corps of Engineers. In a lot of cases, some of this money is actually coming as a result of the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. So you have to ask those folks for permission to spend that money. So you do have to get involved and engaged. I think it starts as simply with just saying you care about this, you care about the coast, and you care about the decisions being made.
So what does the Restore the Mississippi River Delta organization feel needs to be done?
Yeah, thank you for asking that. We've been around for a little while. You knew this. I grew up here. I care about this coastal program for a lot of different reasons, as do so many of your listeners. We want to make sure that they are sticking to this balance of restoration and protection. That was a tough lesson that we learned after Hurricanes Katrina and Rita, that you can't just have levees alone, that you have to be able to protect that protection. Right a couple years after Hurricanes Katrina and Rita, we saw the oil spill. Well, we saw how fragile our coast was. And so we know those multiple lines of defenses need to be reinforced. So those are the things that we're looking for. We're looking for those big, large-scale restoration projects that match the scale of our land loss, and we're making sure that we're sticking to those hard lessons that we learned after the oil spill and after Katrina and Rita. We've been successful. We want to maintain that success.
I don't care what it is. I mean, I do care what it is, but I don't care whether it's restoring the coast. I don't care whether it's building a building, whatever your endeavor happens to be. Start, stop, this direction, that direction can't be a good thing overall. Because you're plotting
Tommy, this against
the timeline, especially when it comes to coastal restoration.
Yes, absolutely. Tommy, you know, we say it so often that, you know, we have no time to lose, that we don't have an unlimited supply of resources, money, and we certainly don't have an unlimited amount of time. And so timelines matter. And you know, how soon we can get a project to construction matters. But also, too, that we're not just making investments that benefit us today, because we're not always going to have money. We're not always going to have time. So we do have to think about those long-term or those future investments as well. I think we've talked about this before, Tommy. It's a little bit of a give a man a fish or teach a man to fish, right? Mm-hmm. We want to make sure that we are taking these precious dollars and investing them not just for our protection today, but for our future coast.
I would like both. I would like to learn how to fish and then
I'll deliver
a bunch of redfish to me. Thank you, Simone. And you can catch them too. I know you. Thank you.
Thank you, Tommy.
You have a good day. You bet. Simone Malaz, campaign director for Restore the Mississippi River Delta. And if you want to get involved, the next meeting, I had it right here in front of me, is a virtual meeting. And I'll give you more details on that when we come back. When we return, we'll talk to Dane Cialino about the coastal litigation and more. The meeting is virtual, and you can find out everything you need to know by going to the website that Simone, how do people find out about this? How do they take advantage of it?
It's easy website, coastal.la.gov. And if you look under calendar, there'll be a direct meeting link there. There's also ap27.coastal.la.gov, where you can find more about the projects that they're planning for this year.
Best news I've heard in a long time, Tim telling me she's still there. Thank you. Appreciate it, Simone.
Thanks, Tommy.
9:38, Dane Cialino. We come back 22 till 10. Traffic now on WWL. 9:45, quarter till 10. Quickly to Dane Cialino, professor of law at Loyola, about the Supreme Court and this coastal damage suit. Good morning, Dane. How are you?
Good morning, Tommy. Just fine.
If you can, please take us a second and give us the underpinnings of this so people understand what we're talking about. Among most of them, me being understanding
right.
what we're talking about.
There have been many dozen lawsuits filed by parishes across the state against oil companies alleging that those companies damaged Louisiana coastal areas and marshland by engaging in oil production activities, cutting canals and those sorts of things that have caused the loss of wetlands. Those cases were brought in state court, and the oil companies have attempted to remove the cases out of state court and bring them to federal court, because typically a federal venue is going to be more favorable to defendants in these sorts of cases than a state venue. The oil companies have not prevailed in their efforts to remove the cases to federal court because they have to establish that essentially the oil companies were working under the direction of a federal officer in matters relating to federal contracts. The argument that they have so far lost is that the government entered into a number of these contracts to get aviation fuel back in the World War II era and post-World War II era. But the Fifth Circuit, the U.S. Appellate Court in New Orleans, found there wasn't enough nexus between the federal contracts and the damage caused by the oil companies. Now, yesterday, the issue was brought to the United States Supreme Court. It's kind of an odd issue. It's a highly technical federal jurisdiction and procedure question, not some interesting issue like abortion or redistricting that we typically see out of the Supreme Court. And the justices seem pretty skeptical of the efforts by the oil companies to get these cases out of state court. I mean, it still remains to be seen what they'll do. But by all indications from the justices' questioning of the lawyers yesterday, these cases look like they're going to wind up staying in state court.
So to be clear, and correct me if I'm wrong, this what the Supreme Court heard has nothing to do with whether or not the oil companies are liable for coastal damages or refilling canals or this or that or the other thing. This is all about what court it should be heard in, or am I making that up?
That's exactly right. It's a highly technical issue under the federal officer removal statute.
So what does it mean for either side? From what you just said, I would guess that the plaintiffs want this to be heard in state court. And what about this Plaquemines deal with the case that's already been decided? What would that do with that verdict? Would that nullify that?
That was a $700+ million verdict that the parish got against these oil companies. The oil companies had attempted to remove it, but were thwarted in that effort. If the Supreme Court says that removal should have occurred and the federal courts did have jurisdiction, then that would imperil that $700 million verdict, and also cause all of the remaining suits pending in state courts across the state to be transferred to federal court.
And I don't want to hurt myself here, but would it render it moot? Because it seems as though if the state court had no right to hear it, then how can you have a verdict?
Exactly. And then the matter would go back to square one in federal court.
How would you proceed from this point if the technical issue aside with... I mean, were there contracts originally? I don't know how closely you followed the Plaquemines Parish case or not, but determine who's responsible for water. Was Louisiana willing to sell its soil? What made me think of this, Dane, was I looked at the timeline of the oil and gas suits. Did all of a sudden after the oil stopped flowing or the easy oil or whatever it was or the oil bust, did suddenly then municipalities say, oh, wait a minute, you damaged us, you this or that? And if the oil industry were still as flowing, pardon the pun, as it were then in its heyday, would any of this even have come to court? And I'm just wondering about how do you go about determining who's responsible for what? There would have had to have been a contract at some point or what? Because you can't just decide you do this and I do that after it's over, right?
Yeah, there clearly were contracts between the federal government and these oil, many of these oil companies to produce aviation fuel.
This was during World War II?
During World War II. Okay. And that is the hook that they're trying to use to say that these oil production and exploration activities that caused the damage to the marsh were done under the direction of the federal government. If they prevail on that argument, then yeah, the matters will be transferred to federal court. But so far, they have not had that luck.
Does this have anything to do with Mr. Goode? Wait, let me clear this up. In terms of, has the government ever been found liable for Mr. Goode? I'm trying to remember here. Not as far as oil exploration, but just in terms of damages.
Yeah, I mean, if you're talking about those post-Katrina lawsuits brought against the Corps of Engineers, no, those were not successful.
Okay, so would that in any way serve as a precedent for this? If you go back and buy the air for or the air fuel theory, then that the government can't—I hate to say—can't make a mistake, but that once the government decides something, they can't be held responsible for whatever happens after that.
Yeah, on the narrow procedural issue and jurisdictional issue that's before the Supreme Court now, no, it would have affected those lawsuits because those lawsuits against the Corps were brought in federal court, not in state court.
Okay. So let me go back here. So it was brought in federal court, not state court. I see. That's what you said with the court?
And this argument, the whole issue before the U.S. Supreme Court now really, as I've said, is really just a jurisdictional and procedural issue.
But if
it doesn't go to the core of who's liable for what.
But if it gets kicked to federal court, could that Mr. Goode thing serve as a precedent for this or any indication of this?
I don't think so. Again, on this issue, it's just about which court the matter should be heard in, and those Mr. Goode matters were all heard in federal court.
And if it gets kicked to federal court, it's certainly not good news for the plaintiffs, correct?
In these cases, no. They are fighting tooth and nail to stay out of federal court, stay in state court.
Thank you, Dane. Anything I misstated or
nope.
You want to fix up? Okay.
Nope.
Thank you, sir. Have a good day.
Thank you, Tommy.
You bet. Dane Cialino, professor of law at Loyola. Quick break. Find out what Newell's got coming up when we return on WWL.